Hello and welcome to The Doctor Will Hear You Now, the podcast hosted by me, Dr. Zoe Williams. Now, I'm a practicing GP and medical professional, but in this podcast series, I'm not the expert. In The Doctor Will Hear You Now, I'm here to learn from you. Each episode, I'll face a health condition which is riddled with stigma and misinformation. By passing the microphone, literally, to a well-known name, join me as I learn their story. Plus, with the help of our wonderful series sponsor, Bupa, we'll be joined a bit later on in each episode by someone who has a lot of experience in the subject matter. Together, we'll leave each episode with a greater understanding. This is The Doctor Will Hear You Now. Today, I'm joined by Adele Tracy, who I'm lucky enough to have met several times over the past few years. And Adele's most famously known for being a professional athlete, competing at 800 metres and now 1500 metres as well. So you'll no doubt know her from her multiple impressive accolades, competing internationally at a European, Commonwealth and world stage level for the past 10 years. And she's actually just reaching her peak. Alongside this, she sneakily leads a double life as a professional hair and makeup artist. So another reason for me to feel just a little bit intimidated by this very impressive lady. The reason that Adele joins us, however, is to open up the conversation about dementia. Adele is the first ever Challenge Events Ambassador for Dementia UK, as her life has been significantly shaped by the disease, notably that of her grandmother. So Adele, thank you so much for joining us today to have this really important conversation.
No problem. Thank you for having me.
You're very welcome. So Adele, we always start off this podcast by asking the same question to the guest. So the question I'm going to ask is, what is the one thing you should never say to somebody whose life has been touched by dementia?
I guess the first thing that springs to mind is probably, do you remember? Asking like a question that's based on memories can really like make someone feel very isolated if they are having trouble to remember or recall things.
So somebody who actually has dementia, avoid asking
them,
do you remember? Before we go a bit more into dementia and how it's touched your life, there are quite a few things that we actually have in common. So we're both mixed heritage. Both of our fathers are Jamaican. Both of our mothers are white British. We both have had an interest throughout our lives in physical activity and actually health as well. Because often when you and I have spoken on panels, you know, that crossover between physical activity and health is what we've been talking about. But you spent the first 7 years of your life growing up in Jamaica, which is something that I haven't experienced. I often feel that I lack connection to my Jamaican heritage. So what was that like, spending 7 years of your life growing up in Jamaica?
Yeah, amazing. I think my memories of growing up in Jamaica are really fond because I lived in a really rural part of Jamaica in the hills in Manchester, a really tiny village called Bethany. Yeah, and so had a really great experience, I guess, of, you know, living in the countryside, growing up in an environment where actually running was, you probably learned to run before you learned to walk.
Yeah.
And it's, you know, the number one sport in Jamaica as well. So that was always, yeah, something that was, I was surrounded by from a really young age. I feel like I had a very freeing and amazing experience growing up there. And when we moved to the UK, I sort of, you know, what you're saying about that connection, I definitely feel like, you know, it's still there because, you know, I'm half Jamaican, but it's, yeah, those memories you look back on very fondly. And actually, it's a very, very different sort of lifestyle when you're living in the UK.
This is something I have to ask you about. I mean, your running career so far has been amazing and you're getting better and better and better. But last year, there was a really important change in that you switched allegiance from being a GB athlete. You're now a Jamaica athlete. So what was the reason for that? I think it's amazing. And how many people with dual heritage get the opportunity to represent both sides of their heritage? But what was the reason for it?
Yeah, I think that's just it. You know, I'm as much Jamaican as I'm British and it felt just like the right time. I had the opportunity to make the switch because COVID actually provided me with that. You actually have to spend 3 years out of the sport in your given event stipulated by World Athletics to be able to make that change.
So by 3 years out, is that 3 years
out of competition,
not competing?
Yeah,
you were probably training. I'm sure you were training throughout, were you?
Yeah, and I was competing, but it's at an international level. And because I'd been injured throughout 2019, 2020, I just missed out on the Olympics. So when it came to 2022, I had this new open window of eligibility. So it's something that I definitely thought about previously, having grown up there, and my dad was a Jamaican athlete. I identified heavily with being Jamaican as well. So it's been, such an amazing experience, and to be part of a team that's really quite iconic when it comes to athletics as well. It's been really special.
And you've had loads of successes then, haven't you? You've won 2 medals. The next competition that you did, you won a silver medal in the 1500 and a bronze medal in the 800. So congrats.
Thank you. Thanks so much. Yeah, it was really special to sort of get my first continental medals as a Jamaican athlete, and to, just be part of that and feel like I'd made that switch, knowing that I'm coming into some really good form as well. It's always nice to be able to, show the team that's you're in great shape and you want to win medals for them.
You're 29 years old, and for a middle distance athlete, that means you're sort of just embarking on your prime. Is that right? And you got your personal best just last year.
Yeah, so personal best in the 800 and the 1500, and I've sort of stepped up into the 1500 too. So that's really cool because I'm still sort of exploring that event. But everyone sort of says you sort of get into your prime in your late 20s, early 30s, and I'm really, really feeling like that. So that's nice.
Even though you were only 7 when you moved to the UK, it sounds like you remember quite a lot to say you were so young. What happened when you moved to the UK? What were the reasons that you moved, and what was that like for you?
Yeah, I think very different culturally coming to the UK. My parents separated, so we moved to be closer to my grandma, who I really saw as my second parent because she was there for the majority of my upbringing and into my adult life. And so, moved in with her initially, and growing up in a multi-generational household, but very, very different to my experiences of growing up with my aunties and a big, big family, because I don't know about you, but the Jamaican side of my family is quite big.
And you said grandma. Did she like to be called grandma?
She did. She very much insisted on being grandma, not granny, not gran, nanny. It had to be grandma. So
grandma. Yeah. And it was Patricia, wasn't it?
Patricia.
And that, that's the person we're here to speak about quite a lot today, because she did get diagnosed with dementia. What's your first memory of hearing the word dementia? Was it before your grandma's diagnosis, or had you come across it before that?
Yeah, I think it was. And I actually want to say that I had Alzheimer's before I heard dementia. And now I feel like I understand that a bit better in terms of, I think I was watching The Notebook, and towards the end of that film, there's that really devastating scene of one of the characters who gets Alzheimer's, and they say that word quite a bit. And so I didn't really associate it with dementia because I thought it was something completely different altogether.
So you thought Alzheimer's and dementia were two different things?
Yeah. And then I guess I must have understood the term when my grandmother was diagnosed. And now I know that obviously Alzheimer's is the cause of dementia. And there's so many types of dementia as well.
Mm-hmm.
But it's something that once you do look into and you educate yourself on that term, I think it takes away the initial, ooh, that doesn't sound like a good word.
Yeah. I guess just to take a moment to clarify that, dementia is really a set of symptoms related to the brain and cognitive ability. And Alzheimer's is the commonest cause of dementia, but as you mentioned, there are lots of other causes as well. So there's vascular dementia, there's something called Lewy body dementia, there's a whole list. What type of dementia was it that your grandma had?
So my grandma had vascular dementia, and we were sort of made aware of that actually quite late. I think it was mainly because she was a very independent woman. She lived on her own, and it's probably the same as me. I wouldn't want to go to the doctor with someone else, and she would take herself to the doctor. And whether she'd heard that diagnosis earlier to when we actually were made aware of it and was in denial or just didn't want to accept it.
Yeah.
Or if it was actually that was setting in and she couldn't relay that information to us. So yeah, we only found out, I would say, maybe a year or two before she passed away.
But you think she'd been living with dementia for quite some time
before
that?
Yeah, I think her symptoms and now knowing more about dementia, it really kind of says to me that it was happening already. Yeah, I wonder if we had been able to support her earlier, how that would have looked.
So tell us a bit more about Patricia, your grandma. What was she like? You said you had this really close relationship because she was like your second parent. When you moved back to the UK, you lived with her. What was she like?
Yeah, she was an amazing lady. She has always wore like loads of colour. And my love for makeup very much came from her as well, because she had an incredible collection of lipsticks. She was always wearing a different shade of pink lipstick, and she had so many of them because she wanted to find the perfect shade. So that kind of summed her up. She lived in colour. She had these beautiful colourful frames that she would wear, and she loved art and creativity. So very vibrant person, very into walking. She used to be a rambler, so I always knew her as someone who was very active as well. It's really devastating to see somebody that you recognise and kind of stands for all those things when you're growing up to just become very, completely opposite, I would say, to a lot of those things that I thought that she stood for.
Yeah. So you said, so the official diagnosis was in 2016. And when was it that she passed away?
So she passed away in 2016, but I'd say her diagnosis was maybe 2014.
Right.
And that took a long time to come about. And I think it was more my mum being able to access that information and know that she had dementia. Before that, we knew that she had suffered quite a few falls. She used to be really active, like I said, and she would go to Switzerland. She'd go on walking holidays on her own, very independent. And she came back from one of those holidays and had quite a bad fall. And I think from there, it was like the confidence had gone to be active. And subsequently, she'd suffered a small stroke. Again, we weren't aware of that until we had that information later on, but she was diagnosed with vascular dementia, which I think has a link to sort of that stroke.
Yeah. So the risk factors for vascular dementia are very much the same as the risk factors for stroke and heart disease, because it's actually the damage to the brain is caused by the blood vessels getting blocked up. There tends to be a slightly different pattern with vascular dementia, and I wonder if this is what your grandma experienced, in that it, with something like Alzheimer's, it tends to be a gradual decline in cognitive ability, so ability to, you know, perform tasks that they used to be able to do, and memory and that type of thing. In vascular, sometimes it's more of a stepwise, you know, there's sort of they seem okay, and then there's a sudden deterioration, and then they stay like that for a while, and a sudden deterioration, because it's when that blood vessel actually blocks, it means that that section of brain doesn't get a blood supply. Did you see that with your grandma?
Yeah, definitely. I think it was a lot to do with change of environment as well. When she would have a bad fall, when she would be admitted into hospital, she'd come out and be very, very confused. And I know that at that point, it was very difficult for her to live on her own. She was living on her own throughout this period. And my mum would come around almost every day to just help her with simple tasks, because like you say, it would be, oh, you're okay, actually. And then all of a sudden, things would sort of change.
Yeah. So how old were you when, you know, when your grandma was going through these years of being quite unwell?
I must have been early 20s. So I was at university and training in the local area. So I'd come back every weekend, but I would only really be seeing her, you know, a couple of times a month. But my mum was there going pretty much every day by then. And I think you notice it more when you're not seeing someone as regularly.
Yeah.
You really see those moments of decline and change. So yeah, it could be quite upsetting at times.
Yeah, tell me more about that. What was it like? I mean, you were at uni, so I guess it wasn't your mum day to day was helping to look after your grandma. Weren't, but and when, I think, how did you feel about going home? And
yeah, I think it was more, I really saw the toll that it took on my mum as well. You know, she's a single parent, she's worked, you know, various different jobs, and I think juggling that with also caring was a real challenge. But also when you're caring for someone who really cares about you and you really care about them, you're so comfortable. And I think that's where the most difficult part of it is, because she got the brunt of my grandmother's frustration and anger, or you know, she wasn't having a good day, she would take it out on mum. So that was quite hard to see my mum upset as well. So it worked in both ways. I think my mum really sheltered us from a lot of that behaviour, and she was actually probably at her best when we were coming to see her because it wasn't as regular.
Yeah, it is. It is really, really sad, and it's the impact, like you say, on the person, but also on those that are around them, the people that care for them. I see that a lot with patients that I care for, where the patient really doesn't want anybody else coming in to help with care, but the relative, often the spouse or the child who's looking after them, is really struggling. I actually saw it in my own family as well. My uncle passed away from dementia last year, and my auntie, you know, she's amazing. I'm sure like your mum was, you know, she, for a very long time, she tried to do it all by herself. And it was a conversation I would have with her quite regularly, just, you know, let's revisit this idea of getting help. How are you feeling about it? And eventually it reaches a point where you can't do it all. I don't know if that was the case with your grandma.
I actually think so. My grandma passed away before she probably should have. She actually got I think it was just an infection. And they said that the toxicity of everything kind of clouded she wasn't in that much pain, but she didn't really know we didn't know how long she'd sort of been in that state, because obviously my mum saw her every day. She might have fallen in the evening or the morning or whatever, and she fell. She was admitted into hospital and sadly passed away from the sort of toxicity of that infection.
Right.
Yeah, it's one of those things, if she had been around longer and she deteriorated even more, I'm not sure what we would have done. I think we definitely would have had to have some sort of support.
You mentioned just before that when you or your siblings came home and you were around her, that actually she seemed better. She was sort of, that there would tend to be good days.
Yeah.
Why do you think that was?
Maybe it is just when you get used to somebody being there all the time, you kind of, you are so comfortable and you do kind of take for granted what they're doing for you. And then maybe because we were less frequently seeing her, it was like, oh, this is somebody new. Yeah, I don't really know. I suppose like we always look up to her as someone that we really respected. So that might be another thing as well, that the way that we treated her was always as, our grandma, and we loved, spending time with her. So the only thing I can think is that maybe there were certain situations where my mum was caring for her where it kind of made her feel like she wasn't that person.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's no disrespect to my mum, because obviously she was doing her best. But I think I try and see it from the other side of it. And that it must be a really difficult thing to be like, I need my handheld to do this, this and this, which I was able to do perfectly fine before on my own.
Yeah. A lot of frustration.
Yeah, I think that's it.
Did your grandma's personality change? Was there any of that, which sometimes happens with dementia?
Yeah, I definitely would say that she lost that colourfulness.
The lipsticks go?
I remember her towards the end getting a purple streak in her hair.
Oh.
And she,
I loved.
She did sort of stop dyeing her hair and, you know, just doing those little acts of self-care, I guess, that give you that boost. I think I always remember her doing her lipstick or wanting her pink lipstick on. But yeah, I do think it's amazing how, you know, those little things shape your identity. And it's sad to see that demise, because, you think if that's something that somebody wants to show themselves, they want to show up that way, they must have got to a point where things are changing a lot for them to not be able to do that.
Incredibly sad that your grandma passed away in 2016. And, you know, nobody ever dies actually of dementia. It's never the first thing that goes on a death certificate, but having dementia does mean you are more at risk of things, especially things like infections. The fact that your grandma never reached a point where a dementia was very, very severe, how do you feel about that? Do you feel that actually you've been robbed of time with her, or that she's been robbed of her time?
Mm-hmm.
On the other hand, is there any relief that she didn't experience life with more severe dementia than she had, or that your mum was in the position of struggling with what to do? What are your thoughts? Maybe it's mixed, I don't know, but what are your thoughts about her dying?
I think it is mixed. When I think of, you know, she was only 80, so that's actually very young. And I think, you know, it's a real shame to not have not had that time with her. You always think like that. But yeah, that I guess there is that sense of relief. I know for my mum as well, knowing that she wasn't going to suffer more than she already was and we weren't going to see that decline again was actually, yeah, it's you know, it means that she's kind of at peace and she's not had to go through that, because I think it would have been just as horrible for her as it would have been for us as well.
So what I want to come and talk a little bit now about your role with Dementia UK. Tell us a bit about that. How did you get involved with them?
So got involved with Dementia UK mainly because I wanted to do something that I felt really passionate about. I'd learned quite a lot of about dementia in the time with my grandma being diagnosed, and I just wanted to, I guess, spread awareness. Being a Black woman of mixed heritage, I felt was really important to kind of show that I guess other people who are structurally positioned like me might want to access those services or see that it was a space for them as well.
Yeah, no, that's really interesting, because you have spoken before about how people of colour may be less likely to access support and access services. I think it's a conversation we're having more and more now about how people of different ethnicities might access healthcare differently and sometimes how they might not necessarily see that something is for them. So is that something you identified and you thought just them seeing you being aligned with the charity might mean that people of colour with dementia or their families might access some of the support services from the charity?
Yeah, I think there is some research out there to support that, and just kind of being in that space sometimes, whether it's, you know, a fear of discrimination that's sort of like preventing that initial consultation to be vulnerable and actually say, I need help, or, you know, if it is actually just accessing that, getting to that point where you can get a diagnosis to get the use of those services. There's lots of different reasons why it happens, but I think, yeah, definitely seeing others in that space and thinking, that's for me, I can use that service.
How important do you think it is for all of us, really, for everyone to have an understanding of dementia? Because I think we often do think of these conditions as we think of the person that has the diagnosis, but an illness like dementia affects everybody close to that person. And it sounds like actually your own personal story. Eventually you knew the diagnosis with your grandma, but maybe there was quite a long period of time before that where you maybe knew things weren't right, but didn't know exactly what was going on. How different would that have been for you if you'd have known what you know now about dementia?
I think it would have not made it such a taboo. Like, no one really spoke about it in our family. And I think that also made it, you know, quite a, you know, tiptoe around, oh, this is, it kind of feels like a bad word almost. And I think the more we can talk about it and normalize that, that it means something different for every person as well, is so important. But I just think there's so much power with knowledge.
And also, as you've mentioned, as you've touched on, some resources available at Dementia UK for people. Now, something that is a real interest of yours and of mine is the links between physical activity and exercise and brain health, and actually how being active over the course of your life can help actually prevent or reduce your risk of getting dementia. Tell us a bit about that.
Yeah, so I was actually really surprised to learn that actually 1 in 3 cases of dementia are preventable. And yeah, one of the ways that we can sort of do that is by just implementing, you know, an active lifestyle, whether that's, you know, going for walks. My grandmother loved going for walks, so we'd frequently do that. Or just, you know, whatever, you know, moving in your chair, your seat, stationary. It really is individual and what makes you feel good. But that's one of the amazing things about exercise. It does make you feel really good, and whether you're caring for someone or you're, you know, living with dementia yourself, it can be a great space to, yeah, just give yourself that time and benefit from the endorphins and proprioception and balance and all those things that come with exercise. So I am, yeah, really proud Challenge Event Ambassador, and hopefully it helps people also raise funds as well as supporting themselves and yeah, exercising.
Well, it's definitely a drum that we both enjoy banging a lot. I think it's fascinating because it's even just sort of 10, 12 years ago, the evidence around the benefits of physical activity and things like brain health wasn't very robust. But now, you know, we can sing from the hills because we know that the message we're giving is absolutely right, that moving your body, as you rightly say, in whatever way you enjoy, whatever way you want to, one of the best things you can do for your mental health and your physical health, and even helps reduce your risk of dementia.
Thank you, Adele. And we're going to bring somebody else in to join our conversation who has a lot of experience when it comes to dementia right after this break.
Before we continue with this important conversation, here's a quick message from our sponsor, Bupa. Dementia is not one medical condition, but a term used to describe a group of symptoms that occur when brain cells stop working properly. Alzheimer's is the most common type of dementia, but there are other types too. They all affect different parts of the brain, so they may affect different people in different ways. Signs could include, but are not limited to, memory loss that affects day-to-day abilities, although this isn't the case for everyone, difficulty performing familiar tasks, or even acting out of character. Over time, as dementia gets worse, a person will need more support to carry out daily living activities, such as eating, getting dressed, and washing. If a loved one is struggling to live alone, or it's becoming difficult to keep on top of their care needs, it might be time to consider a specialist dementia care home where 24-hour care is offered. Bupa knows that having to make decisions about your loved one going into a dementia care home can be very difficult. If you're looking for support, their helpful customer care advisors offer free advice, an understanding chat, and help to find just the right dementia care home. Search Bupa Dementia for more information. So I'm delighted now to welcome Fran Vandelli to this conversation, because Fran, you have so much experience when it comes to dementia. Not only did your grandmother also have Alzheimer's dementia, but you've got experience at working at so many different levels within the system, from working in care homes, looking after people who are living with dementia, to working for the council, to leadership, and now you work with Bupa as one of their dementia leads. So it's a real honour to have you. Thanks for joining us.
Pleasure.
First of all, it'd be great to hear a little bit about your experience in this space of working and supporting people with dementia.
I came to dementia care as a job role quite late. My grandmother was diagnosed with Alzheimer's disease, and I didn't really understand the disease at all in any way. And I often wondered why I could stop her from getting out of a moving car and encourage her to eat and, you know, stop her from running away down the road without getting into an argument or without any, you know, any anger from her. And I never really understood what was going on for her.
Was it that with other people, she responded differently then?
Yes. Yeah. And their responses to her kind of fueled it as well. And I didn't understand what was going on in her brain. I didn't understand what was driving her behaviour.
I'd love to ask you, the conversation that Adele and I just had, obviously you were listening to, was there anything in that conversation that you really, you know, you wanted to add to or question or pick up or correct?
One thing that's really evident to me is the number of times there's an assumption that people's changes in behaviour are a sign of change in personality. But it's my profound belief that the person living with dementia continues to be themselves, continues to have the same personality, but that what happens is, because of impairment of various lobes, and particularly the executive centre of the brain that helps us control our emotional responses and also helps us to understand what's appropriate and what's not appropriate in any set of circumstances, you know, that sometimes becomes disinhibited. And so because that can change behaviour, there's an assumption that it's a personality change or that someone is disappearing. But, you know, for me, the individual is still there in the centre of that experience of being surrounded by a cloud of dementia and confusion. And all the stress that goes with trying to navigate a world when you don't understand it anymore. And that accounts for the behaviour change. I mean, I do know that with front lobe dementias, personality can change. But in general, you know, I think it's unkind to assume that the person has disappeared. We must always act as if the person is there locked in. And if you find the keys, we can connect with them. Can I just say, your description of going home to see your grandmother, it just sounds like what worked for her was this emotional connection, you know, a familiar face, a loved person, being treated with respect, meeting those psychological needs that people have.
you know, to have their identity recognised, you know, to be surrounded by loving grandchildren, just, you know, it made that connection that lifted a cloud. And what you were seeing was her at her best. She was still there inside. And, you know, what a joy to have brought that kind of moment to somebody. Wonderful, wonderful.
It really, really was a part of the conversation that, you know, touched me as well when you spoke about that. I think especially because I could feel that you really felt for your mum as well, because you spoke about how, because your mum was there day to day, you know, you felt she took the brunt of it, and almost like your grandma would sort of be do her best for you sort of thing. And I could tell there were sort of mixed emotions around that, it felt like.
Yeah, it feels unfair that you get that experience of someone, and then the other hand is, yeah, my mum's experience, which wasn't always the same. So yeah.
And Fran, you spoke about how with your grandma, you were able to support her in not, I guess, these sort of dangerous behaviours, jumping out of a moving car, or, you know, walking out of a shop and wandering off and getting lost. It was much easier for you to support her with those tasks than others. Why do you think that was?
Because conflict resolution and understanding the dynamics of what drives behaviour in the intact mind, if you like, is a strategy that I think we should apply to all of our interactions. So for me, a person living with dementia is first and foremost the person that they always were, with likes, dislikes, you know, psychological needs. And if we use conflict resolution strategies that we would, you know, before their dementia, in order to navigate a difficult conversation, you can get equally far. And the better you know someone, the easier it is.
Tell me a bit more about what you mean by conflict resolution. And you use that term. Describe a little bit more what that actually means. And I guess what I'm trying to push you for is perhaps some tangible tips and takeaways that other people who are in what can sometimes be a really stressful, difficult situation caring for somebody with dementia, some practical tips that people can take away which might help.
Okay, so I think it's about, I would call it probably, to sum it up in one phrase, good customer service.
Right.
So how do you say no to someone without saying no?
Yeah.
So I'm not going to say no, you can't go. I'm going to say, you know, if we go, I wonder if we should do it this way. Let's do that and then we'll do this. Or I'd love to do it, but I can't because. Or maybe we need to find out from someone else what we need to do first before we do this. So I'm not saying no.
Okay. That's really powerful, isn't it, actually, when you think about, you know, the word no, we don't want to hear that word. That creates a whole range of emotions. But actually, you've just given several examples there of ways to essentially say no without saying no.
Absolutely.
Or certainly at least no for now.
Exactly. It doesn't sound like you're saying no. And I think one of the reasons why no, you can't, no, you're not allowed to, no, you mustn't, no, it's dangerous, is so provocative, is because there's a role reversal, you know, where we end up looking after our parents,
yeah,
who for themselves, they may be confused about a lot of things, but their role in relation to their power with us feels pretty clear to them. It's part of their identity. And so, you know, I know that I need to acknowledge someone's psychological need to have their identity intact. So I'll navigate my answers according to what will meet their need for identity. And in general, that's, you know, being respectful.
Yeah.
And not sounding like I'm the grown up.
Now, Adele's spoken about the links between physical activity and brain health, and especially, you know, this research we now have, which shows that there is for many of us, we can reduce our risk of dementia by being active. What are your views and thoughts on that?
It's really clear that good physical health is fundamental to protecting yourself from the decline of all kinds. But we know that there's associations with declining health and, you know, the speed that someone declines and deteriorates with their dementia. So, you know, if someone loses their mobility, if they're not being mobile, and you mentioned that your grandmother stopped walking. So if you reduce your core muscle strength, and if you have some visual impairments, you increase your risk of falls. So with hip fractures and other time spent in hospital comes an increased confusion, the likelihood of delirium, lack of access to nature out of doors, which will give you a decline in mental health, maybe social isolation, and you might get depressed. And so with delirium and depression, some of those symptoms are the same as the symptoms of dementia. So if you are already progressing with something at such a low level that it's not impairing your life in general, and then you add delirium to that and depression, a dementia that's already developing, you'll speed up the decline.
Right.
When someone's had a fall, they lose a lot of confidence, and lower self-esteem and lack of confidence will have an impact on motivation. And dementia can impede your motivation, your get up and go, and your ability to initiate things. You impair yourself further, or those conditions impair somebody further. So it's just fundamental to good all-round health and protection from decline. You know, we're all familiar with the term use it or lose it. And yeah. It's so true.
Yeah.
You said that people don't normally die from dementia. And I think you were talking about what gets written on
the death certificate.
On the death certificate.
Yes.
So I just wanted to clarify for anyone who isn't aware that dementia is progressive, that all dementia illnesses are progressive illnesses, and that they are terminal as well. But you're quite right, people die from a lot of other things before they actually pass away from the dementia. And that's rarely what's written on the death certificate.
And yeah, so that's right. So physical activity can, one, reduce your risk of getting dementia in the first place, but also can be important in the progression of disease in somebody who has it. But it's not just about physical activity, is it? You know, there are many things when it comes to our physical health and our lifestyle. It's not just about having an active lifestyle. There are other things that are important to minimise our risk as much as possible, such as healthy nutrition. Deafness is a really interesting one, actually. If people suffer from deafness and it's not treated, that's been linked to dementia. What are some of the others?
Just want to clarify a little bit in that I think what we do is reduce our risk rather than stop it from happening altogether.
Yes.
Because
yeah,
there's so many genetic factors.
There's
so many genetic factors that are involved in whether or not someone will develop dementia. So there's no cast iron guarantee that you will stop yourself from getting dementia if you eat this, do that. I mean, I remember when pineapples and turmeric were preventative measures for dementia and so on. So I don't think there's a cast iron way of stopping yourself from getting it. It's about slowing down the speed, reducing the likelihood. And with things like vascular dementia, there's more we can do because we know good cardiovascular health prevents you from having more of those mini strokes that cause the damage that you spoke about earlier.
Yeah. Well, I think that's really important, actually, because I think a good way I've heard this be explained before is that your genetics give you a range of possibilities. Mm-hmm. And if we think about that in terms of dementia, there is, for some people, sadly, even if they live the healthiest lifestyle, their genetics mean that they will get dementia. You know, luckily that is a very small proportion of people. And at the other end, there are people who can live whatever lifestyle they want and they will never get dementia. And then there's everything in between. So each of us has a risk of possibilities, which is determined by our genetics. But then our lifestyles determines how likely we are to swing to one side or the other. So, you know, I think that's really important. You can't absolutely, there's nothing you can do to eliminate, you know, completely prevent dementia, but there are things you can do to adjust your risk.
Absolutely, absolutely. And, you know, who knows what medical science will do soon?
Yes, well, fingers crossed.
In terms of, absolutely.
We're constantly, aren't we, hearing about new drugs for dementia, and you know, on the horizon there is, in the past 6 months there has been a bit of a breakthrough, and I'm always reluctant to get too excited when it comes to new treatments for dementia, especially because, you know, sadly these breakthroughs don't necessarily help people who are suffering with dementia right now. You know, we know it'll be many, many years before they come to market. I'm sure there will be a day in the future where dementia will be a thing of the past.
If I may, my view would be not to describe people as suffering with dementia.
Living with.
I think, yeah, living with.
Yeah.
Because it is possible to live well when you're living with dementia. And yet it's also really tiring. It's an exhausting thing to live with every day. And I think that contributes to the demand on carers.
Yeah.
Is that, you know, they're supporting someone who is exhausted as well as confused.
There's one final question that I'd like to ask you, Fran. It's really building on what Adele and I spoke about earlier. I think there'll be people listening to this podcast who want to go and have a conversation with a loved one afterwards because they may be concerned that they may have dementia, but nobody's discussed it in the family. And I wonder whether, is there a specific sentence, a specific phrase that we can empower people with that is a safe, kind way to open up that conversation?
I think there is. And I think we need to understand what's making someone cautious about going to the GP. You know, people might already have suspected that something was different and notice it themselves. Because in the earlier stages of dementia, people tend to have insight into the fact that things are changing and things feel very different. You know, I know someone who first noticed she was developing dementia because she was driving home from work and she forgot the way home. So my view would be the most supportive way of getting someone to get to the GP is you might say, do you know, I've noticed something. Have you noticed that your memory's not the same as it was? There's something really weird. I think we probably need to go to the GP and rule out hormone change or thyroid problems. You know, the process of diagnosing dementia is always one of ruling out before anything else.
Absolutely.
And there are so many things that can cause the same impairments and symptoms early on that you might as well just focus on ruling out and getting treated what's treatable.
I was just listening to everything that you're saying and it's so amazing to hear that actually, I guess it's just having that lived experience with my grandmother and you kind of saying the reasons why she might have felt like there was a change of behaviour or, you know, she was acting differently and the reasons for that. It's just really interesting. I'd never really thought of it like that before, that actually the reversal of those roles of my mum being sort of, you know, mum and her feeling like she was the child might have also been triggering that behaviour.
When you have to start giving people support with intimate personal care, you know, there are boundaries there where people feel their dignity compromised quite a lot by their, you know, sons and daughters having to support them in that way or their spouse having to support them in that way. So it adds an extra layer of complexity of feeling and upset and humiliation and so on that people struggle to navigate.
Fran, I think something else that people find helpful, and it's again something that came up in the conversation between Adele and I, is when you're caring for a family member, very much like Adele's mum was with her grandma, when that time comes where actually you are struggling to cope, and at some point often it becomes necessary for there to be additional help and support to look after the person. I'm sure in your job, in your experience, you've had lots of conversations around that. You know, can you offer any advice to people who might be listening about how to approach that? You know, if you're a carer and you feel that you need some additional help, but the person you're caring for is not keen, what's the best way to approach that difficult situation?
People who are being cared for feel like they are the reason why, and they are the subject of the help. I need someone to come in and help me with you. I think that can make people feel quite defensive. No, I don't need any help. I can cope.
Yeah.
Whereas, you know, I'm exhausted and I'm not feeling very well. I need someone to come and help me with the housework. And it would be really nice if they came over and did some of this. Is that okay? To prevent me from becoming ill, stressed, strained, depressed, whatever. I think people feel very differently about that. They wouldn't want anyone else to suffer.
I think that's brilliant advice. I think that's really, really helpful advice. Adele, thank you so, so much for joining us and just being so open and sharing all of that. And Fran, for adding everything that you've added. Thank you.
You're most welcome.
Of course. Thank you for having us.
And can I just say thank you, Adele, for being that champion to spread the word about dementia and being a role model for how people can access and support and not feel that dementia has too much of a stigma attached to it and that somehow or another this is a bad word. So thank you.
Yeah, and thank you for all that you're doing, because yeah, you're really helping to care for people with dementia, and that's a massive, massive thing.
Two amazing women, thank you. And thank you for joining me, Dr. Zoe Williams, on The Doctor Will Hear You Now. For future episodes, to make sure that you're the first to know of their release, click follow wherever you're listening right now. Also, tell us if you liked it. Leave a rating or review or share with a friend. You can find me on Instagram at Dr. Zoe Williams, and I look forward to hearing from you again soon.
Insanity Group.
Thank you to our fantastic series sponsor, Bupa. Here's a quick message from them. Dementia is not one medical condition, but a term used to describe a group of symptoms that occur when brain cells stop working properly. Alzheimer's is the most common type of dementia, but there are other types too. They all affect different parts of the brain, so they may affect different people in different ways. Signs could include, but are not limited to, memory loss that affects day-to-day abilities, although this isn't the case for everyone, difficulty performing familiar tasks, or even acting out of character. Over time, as dementia gets worse, a person will need more support to carry out daily living activities, such as eating, getting dressed, and washing. If a loved one is struggling to live alone, or is becoming difficult to keep on top of their care needs, it might be time to consider a specialist dementia care home where 24-hour care is offered. Bupa knows that having to make decisions about your loved one going into a dementia care home can be very difficult. If you're looking for support, their helpful customer care advisors offer free advice, an understanding chat, and help to find just the right dementia care home. Search Bupa Dementia for more information.